From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, actor and playwright Anna Deavere Smith will join us. Her new one-woman show is called Field Notes, Doing Time and Education, the California Chapter. In it, she digs into whether the school system fails children of color. She interviewed over 100 Northern Californians involved in education about why school dropouts are more likely to end up in prison. Then at 10:30, we talk to Bay Area actor and playwright Dan Hoyle. His new show is called Each and Everything, and in it he pokes fun at our online addictions and takes us to a digital detox camp in Northern California and to the most famous coffee house in Calcutta, India, among other locations. We'll hear excerpts from the show, and we'll also hear Hoyle's thoughts on how the digital age is changing us. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. MacArthur Award-winning playwright and performer Anna Deavere Smith joins us for this Forum segment. The creator and performer of multiple voices in 18 one-person shows, including Twilight and Let Me Down Easy. She's also known for her television work in such series programs as The West Wing and Nurse Jackie, and is taught as a professor at Stanford, presently is a professor at NYU. The author of Talk to Me, Listening Between the Lines, she's a recipient of many awards, including the Dorothy and Lillian Gish Award and the National Humanities Medal awarded to her by President Obama. Her new work in progress, a result of some 100 interviews, concerns education and the school-to-prison pipeline and is titled Field Notes, Doing Time in Education, the California Chapter. She joins us in studio for this Forum segment. Good to have you back and good to see you again.
It's always great to see you. We were just saying that, you know, I'm one of the early people who came on this show and when you first started, and you're celebrating your 20th year.
Well, just celebrating.
So fabulous.
It's 21. I've reached my 21. Majority now.
Wow.
But I'm always delighted to have you here. And that's right. You're one of the guests from way back when we started. Both feeling those years, I guess, and how fleeting they are. I want to let listeners know what's going on with this new project of yours because, well, it's really important. And you're talking about largely kids who are poor, kids of color, kids who often really get thrown out of school right away because of, no tolerance projects and those sorts of things in schools. And this is still a work in progress. We're going to hear a little piece of it before the segment is over. But we're talking about kids who really need education and yet just aren't having the opportunity. They drop out, they get expelled, they get suspended, or violence leads to their being away from school.
Yes. Well, I think there's the president, President Obama and many of the people who are working with him are also paying attention to this. He now has an initiative called Brothers Keeper, which is particularly to try to help Black, Brown, and Native American kids who are very vulnerable to the types of things that keep them from finishing their educations. And there's a lot of research being done and has been done about the relationship of early suspensions, for example, for sometimes things which would be considered mischief in other environments, and how these suspensions and even how first times and showing up in court end up to a sort of a cycle of incarceration. So this type of this reality, which is happening to kids, also ends up in the long run destroying communities.
Well, just some numbers for listeners who don't know of these numbers. 68% of inmates have no high school diploma. 70% are the result of foster care, have gone through foster care, and only 20% or so have basic literacy. So these are pretty revelatory in themselves. And when you talk about, as you do in this program, in this work in progress, as I know, about abuse and neglect and about all the problems that many of these kids face, arrests that lead to incarceration, and emphasize how important an education is, you also emphasize love. I mean, from what I've been reading, as maybe the end. Talk about how that works here, because I assume you're still active in Grace Cathedral.
I am.
We're talking about Christian love?
That's actually a very interesting question. I'll tell you that when I talk to a lot of the people who are working very hard to turn this around in communities right here in Philly, Stockton, and Eureka, and then further north to Klamath, where there's the Yurok tribe. Those are the areas I've been doing research in so far. But in urban environments, it's very frequent that the people who are the teachers or the social workers who are trying to turn this around tend to be Christians. And so I've been asking a question to those who do express their faith. Well, what would Jesus think? And actually, the head probation officer for the city of San Francisco is a person I asked that question of. And he said, Jesus would say, bring them to me. And I think that's just a very powerful idea, because most of us, I think, in this country want to push that which is problematic, unattractive, and poor away from us. So, you know, it's useful to think of another way of thinking about the people who are being left behind. And it is also the case that we're living in an environment where education is hard for everybody to, I would say, feel easy about, right? I mean, I teach people who at NYU have a lot of privileges. And I started teaching here in San Francisco at ACT in 1975. And my students have become wealthier and wealthier, but also more and more afraid of saying the wrong thing or afraid of appearing to be dumb. And I think, you know, sort of the whole testing craze, which has been a real part of their lives, is something that has changed the idea of what education could be for everybody, which is a joyous affair, you know, turning you on to your sort of innate abilities to know things and want to know things. And then, of course, it's very serious with the group of young people that I'm looking at right now. And I think that this denies them not just the possibility of having an education, but the possibility of being productive people in our society.
There's a real ideological battle that goes on. It's come up time and time again in this program. I use Diane Ravitch and Michelle Rhee as the two ends of the continuum. You know, on the one hand, it's the fault of the teachers. It's the fault of, you know, the unions and so forth. On the other hand, it's the fault of poverty. And we go round and round on that. But you have said, I think publicly, that you feel that we're almost back to where we were in 1954 when Plessy versus Ferguson was overturned by Brown versus the Board of Education.
Well, a lot of people have been talking about that because we're celebrating the 60th year, the so-called anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. And so a lot of people are pointing out that we're more segregated than ever. And I think that what that raises is a question about whether law is enough. You know, it is important what happened with Brown versus Board of Ed. It opened up the door for a lot of things that are good. I'm not having to drink out of a colored water fountain. You know, not very many people are being lynched in this country anymore. However, you know, if you look at it, looks like we don't really want to be together or spend time together. And so, you know, how much can law do, and how do you really get at the will of the people?
Anna DeVere Smith is our guest in studio, and we're going to hear something from her new work in progress. Let me give you some details about that. She'll be speaking at a series of public town halls presented by the Berkeley Repertory Theater and Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Next month, July 17th, she'll give a stage reading and will appear along with local jazz musician Marcus Shelby, who we featured recently on Forum on July 17th at 8 p.m. at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts Theater. And this is all exciting. And you've said that your muse were those people over in graduate education in Stanford.
A lot of them. Man, I don't know. You work for the CIA. I don't know where you get your information, but I'm kind of astounded about how much you know already about this work that's barely off of my computer. Yeah, well, yes. I mean, they're really...
I was once actually accused of working for the CIA by Amiri Baraka because I said something about... that's a great anecdote, but I'll tell you maybe if you're interested off air.
First of all, did you also mention that I will be... doing a stage reading as part of this series at Yerba Buena on the 17th. Did you plug that too, or did you just say Berkeley Rep?
No, I said,
Yerba Buena
at
too?
The 17th, beginning
okay.
A stage reading. Yes.
Good. So, my first interview for this project was of the then dean of the Stanford University School of Education, Claude Steele. And then I talked to a bunch of the people.
Shelby Steele's twin brother.
That's right. And they're very different. I talked to a group of hot shots over there, among them, of course, Linda Darlingham and Prudence Carter and Sean Reardon and other colleagues of theirs. And so that really sort of kick-started the work. And then I spent time last summer in Stockton, which is, as you know, a bankrupt city, and then went north to Eureka and as I mentioned earlier, the Yurok tribe, and then came back here and did some more interviews around here.
Talked to a lot of the kids, too, didn't you?
I've talked to kids. Yeah. Of course I've talked to kids.
My right hand is up, you see. I have not ever been a member of the Central Intelligence Agency. I'm not now, nor ever will be. Can we hear something from
you? Would I do this. And I thought about this coming up in the elevator because the person that I want to perform for you is a great philosopher of education who was a sort of unofficial mentor of mine. You know, she and Studs Terkel, I know you remember that he had a huge influence on me, and they were both of the same generation. She just passed away about, maybe barely 2 weeks ago at 96 or 98 years old. Maxine Green, very well known to people at Teachers College in New York. And this is called Factories. But the institution itself was modeled after the factory. The institution, she's talking about schools, of course.
And this is her voice. We
this
should tell
her voice, yeah. Something of her voice. Brooklyn woman. But the institution itself was modeled after the factory when it started. And I always tell people when they put clocks in classrooms and they tried to impose like clock time on children who grew up in farms, you know, like for example, to put the principal in an office that makes you frightened to go. Or even when I go to a school, I stand at the clerks. I'm very nervous. If they're busy, I don't know if I should say anything. And it's all structured sort of like a factory with a boss and where the work. And I think that's a part of it. It's linked to the acceptance of hierarchies. I can't stand that. You know, and the only thing I can think is, you know, Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, who's so admired, had a bill, one of the first bills for public education, and it meant he had like schools. Out of the first 3 years, they would choose 10 kids, and after the next 3 years, they'd choose more. But it was for excellence, but it was a very like a meritocratic kind of thing, you know? You choose the worthy one, and he said, you throw away the rubbish. And the rubbish were the poor kids who couldn't make it. I could show you in his notes on the state of Virginia. Yeah. You throw away the rubbish after you get the excellent ones who will appreciate our rational legislators. And when you think of the impact that these denials had, that great spokesman who had slaves and didn't let them go when he died. Incredible. And I'm not sure that, but I have felt in teacher education, I shouldn't be so cynical because I've been a big shot there, a sort of lack of depth of understanding. Like, for example, I was doesn't mean much to you, American Education Research Association. It was like 80, all kinds of members at conventions, had 10,000 people. And I used to speak there a lot. And man, somebody called me, says, you've been nominated as president. I said, oh, not me, because the numbers crunches these people. He said, don't worry, you'll never be elected. But I was. I was on a wave. But I think, you know, I mean, you know, these people that I tell, you know, these people that I tell, they're nice, they're warm, they drink, they're this bit. They don't know about ambiguity. They don't know about darkness. They don't know what children suffer, you know. They're liberating principles like Debbie used to have a family group every morning. Five kids would meet with a teacher. She said, we can't have a school where we don't know that somebody died the night before.
Oh. You have reincarnated her, obviously. Talk about the process a bit. I mean, you record, you got her down. I mean, even her little mannerisms, her idiosyncrasies, her pauses, and her—I mean, it's mimicking, but it's much more than that. It's more of a kind of absorption, isn't it?
Well, yes, and my grandfather, as I've said on this show before, said if you say a word often enough, it becomes you. And so my project has been going around America with a tape recorder, trying to become the country by becoming the words and sounds of the people. But the reason I picked Maxine is to say to you and your audience that this is not new. That deep in the foundation of what this country is, and you can find it in the notes on the state of Virginia that Thomas Jefferson wrote.
Well, he was elitist in many of his views. Well, no question. He was a slave owner,
but he
gave us the Declaration of Independence.
Well, nothing's good without contradictions, I suppose. So we are in that state now of throwing away the rubbish.
Talking with Anna DeVere Smith, let me open our phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us. And you may want to react to what you just heard Anna perform from her work in progress, which again is called Field Notes, Doing Time in Education, the California chapter. You may have a question for her or a comment for perhaps having seen her work. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, and it's yours if you'd like to join us. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum, and of course, you can also use our Facebook page. And here's Frank, who writes on our Facebook page, I wish all these well-meaning people would stop calling it the school-to-prison pipeline. Schools are not setting people on the path to prison. Call it the poverty to prison pipeline, or the no safety net to prison pipeline, or the war on drugs to prison pipeline, some more accurate term.
Well, I think that's right. I don't think the slogan is a very good slogan myself, because it's also kind of hopeless, isn't it? But that is what it has been called. I met a very interesting lawyer here who said, you know, my pipeline is a school to prostitution pipeline. And she's talking about young, you know, girls in particular who are wrapped up in that from school. But I think the person who just wrote in to you is exactly right to assess that so much of this does have to do with poverty. And I think by blaming schools, the danger is we blame teachers. And I think they've taken a bigger hit than they really need to. And it could be that our schools have never been built to really be the sort of catch-all net of other failures of other institutions. Many of the children I'm finding out who end up in this situation are kids who are suffering from trauma, who are suffering from what a very, very fascinating pediatrician here, Nadine Burke-Harris, calls toxic stress. And so there are ways that many institutions are going to have to come together to try to make these young people well in so many ways. And I don't think schools are going to be able to do it all.
Let me bring a caller on. Neil joins us. Hi, Neil.
Yes. I wonder if you've taken any looks at private schools, or if you have any takes or opinions on private schools, Catholic schools, for instance, or any of the more accessible private schools.
Or the charter schools, maybe.
Well, not necessarily, but the ones that are operating that are not as directly supervised by government.
Can we ask the gentleman why he's interested in private schools?
I went to Catholic schools for 9 years, and the contrast between them and public schools could hardly be greater. Frankly, I thought of my 3 years in high school as a three-year sentence, and the 9 years I spent in Catholic schools were not idyllic, but they were certainly better than that.
Well, I mean, I'm not a specialist in private schools. I did teach some teachers last year, actually, at the Chapin School in New York, which is a very very good private school there. I would say that what's very clear is that there are more resources. And I couldn't help myself when I went to teach at Chapin and went to speak at Spence, which is also a very nice school. When I walked in, you know, each of those schools, a very nice lady sitting at the front door. And as I walked in, I would say, oh, no metal detectors.
Neil, thanks for the question. What kind of responses did you get from the kids? I mean, I'm sure it was a wide range, but did you glean anything particularly?
Well, I have an easier time myself. The children are harder to talk to, but the ones who speak more are actually the kids who are in trouble. The kids who are in school and doing well, it's harder to talk to them. I did hear this expression that I'd never heard before, that all the parents who are listening in here all the time, but because I teach college kids, till I did this project, I never heard this expression, test anxiety. Oh, yeah. So you get a fifth grader who can evaluate how, not just how he did on a test, but all the reasons he did well or didn't do well. So you got, you know, fifth graders talking about test anxiety.
Let me go to more of our callers. Let's welcome Margaret. Good morning. You're on.
Oh, hello. I work as a substitute teacher in my town, and I'm not going to say what it is because I know something that I'm not sure how well it's. Anyway, let me just say there are these small schools here called small necessary schools, and I've subbed at a number of them, and I've seen the staff, and had their kids who I know, you know, would likely be on the street or heaven knows. But the people who teach there really watch over their lives, and I every time I see them, I just bless them for the work they're doing. But these schools are being closed in this community, which is terrible. That's basically it. And also, I want to thank Anna DeVere Smith for her wonderful work and for the voice of Maxine Green, who is someone who's known to me. I have friends who've studied with her, and that was a thrill. Thank you so much for your work. Thanks.
Thank you.
It really does honor her. I'm glad you did that. Really pleased and gratified that you did that.
You talked about love before.
Yeah.
The thing that's so great about Maxine, and another thing I love about that piece, is when she talks about a principal in New York who gathers the kids together every day. Because how can you have a school where you don't know that somebody died the night before? I actually think that's relevant to any group. I told you beforehand that I'm finishing up a workshop now at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts with adults and all kinds of people, not just
it's
actors.
One of your personal narrative workshops?
A personal narrative workshop. And for anybody who's listening, there's $10 tickets still available for tonight at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, 7 o'clock. It's going to be really a lot of fun, a very diverse group of people coming from all kinds of backgrounds, from my lawyer who came up from L.A. to young psychiatrist to actors and dancers, wonderful, wonderful group of people. One of them on Saturday was coming over from Oakland and, was chased by a guy who tried to rob her backpack in a sort of empty subway station. And it's kind of like, you know, how could we, the 40 of us, work that day without knowing that the person there had been, you know, shook up and almost hurt and harmed. So I think that's another thing, is the kinds of stories I hear from these kids, the kinds of things that they've gone through in their lives, and yet the schools aren't necessarily equipped to deal with that whole person, the amount of violence that's there. Even Arne Duncan, when I spoke
Secretary
to him,
of Education.
Secretary of Education, you know, talks about how we have to look at the effect of the violence in these communities on how the state of kids, how they are. Victor Carrion, who's a psychiatrist at Stanford, writes about, as Nadine Burke-Harris does, the effect of trauma and stress on cognitive development, not just emotional development. So, and by the way, I think the good news is that there are people like Dr. Carrion, people like Dr. Burke and many others who are looking at this kind of scientifically.
Well, you look at it also theatrically. I mean, it's amazing to me how you take on these healthcare, education, race relations, and invest yourself and your art in those and really also heighten and make people much more galvanized, perhaps, in terms of their attention. We're coming to the end of the hour. Alas, the end of the half hour, because we were... you know Dan Hoyle's work?
I do.
He's also a solo performer.
Yeah. Well, is he in town?
We're going to meet him next, actually.
Okay, great.
We kind of bracket the two of you segment by segment.
Wonderful. But
looking forward to this work. Again, Anna DeVere Smith, she'll be doing a series of public town hall presentations by the Berkeley Repertory Theater and Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Next month, July 17th, a stage reading that you mentioned will appear, along with local musician Marcus Shelby, 8 p.m. at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. $10 tickets still available. Thank you for being with us. Always good to see you.
Nice to see you.
You're listening to Forum. We'll be back. Dan Hoyle joining us in the next segment. I'm Michael Krasny.